When I finished my master's at Melbourne Uni, one of the few places I could work as a specialist in, as a clinical psychologist in public mental health, was in aged psychiatry. And so I worked in aged psychiatry for a number of years in community-based teams throughout the metropolitan area. And then about 10 years ago, set up my own company, training staff throughout Australia in various ways of using psychology to support staff and family carers in the care of people with dementia.
How is it possible? Dementia affects our ability for cognitive thought and memory. So how does any kind of psychoanalytical approach have effect? I can't remember what we talked about, and my functioning is less. So even if I can remember it and I started applying these thought patterns, I then am unable to do that in the upcoming months. So how do you work, I guess?
Okay. I guess one of the first things to say about a human person is that we exist within a social context. And so we have people around us who either know us or have some sort of background for us. And so we bring a lot of, even if we can't remember what we had for breakfast this morning, we still have some other memories of prior experience that the people around us might be able to trigger off. So, for instance, knowing the life story of the person becomes a crucial part of providing care for somebody with dementia.
So you wrote about this very well, about marshmallows, and because that reminded the patient of good times in the Scouts.
That's right.
And you give examples of how to talk about, so, hey, you were in the Scouts and you had marshmallows, or alternately, leading it in other ways to trigger a happy memory with a food.
That's right.
And join the two. Mm.
Memory is a bit like a net. If you imagine pulling one part of the net, what you do is you activate many aspects of that net. So memory is very much associative. So even though one particular memory might have been lost, there are other associations that the person still has. And bear in mind, we have billions of neurons that have millions of connections. So what we have is a surplus of possibilities within our neural networks that enable us to sustain memory, and even in the face of decline. So there's a lot of research these days to suggest that the brain is a very plastic thing, able to be changed, to be assisted. So as a psychologist, what I do is I try and work with staff and family carers to support them in and find ways to, as it were, support the person's brain, so that they can continue to function as best as possible in the face of this declining condition. So what we're trying to do is hold the person up, as it were, hold them intact and keep them functioning to the maximum of their possibility by providing as supportive an environment around them and an environment that triggers off things that will lead to success.
You're chatting with Bernie McCarthy. He's written the book Hearing the Person with Dementia. In the book, he talks, actually, there's so many things we need to talk about in this, but just picking up on what you said, you talk about how to modify your language. So I don't say sit there. I might be more specific. Bend your knees, put your bottom on the chair.
Yeah.
So these kind of things. Or you get dressed, I'll be back in a moment.
No, right.
I don't say that. I say, Bernie, just put your underpants on. And so in other words, I break it down into its core things.
Its
I don't
components.
Do these simple which we'd think, of course, you know, I'd tell Bernie, get dressed, I'll be back in a minute, mate. And I come back, Bernie, you've done nothing. Come on, we're going to be late. So those sort of conversations, trying to stop those conversations.
That's right. Particularly, say, with somebody who has Alzheimer's disease, one of the characteristics of Alzheimer's disease is that it robs us of words, of particular names for things. So by providing the person with the name for the thing that you want them to use or to go towards or to stay away from, what we do is we save their brain the effort of having to find that word so that we make it easier for the person to succeed. So by saying, instead of saying sit there, we might say sit in this chair. Be specific, be directional. It makes it easy for the person's brain to accept that information.
It makes it less distressing for the person, I imagine, because, you know, Bernie's telling me to do things. I'm not sure what they are. And then I feel, oh, God, I'm losing my mind. And I get distressed and I'm worried. And then Bernie's cross with me because I haven't done that thing that he asked me to do, but I'm not sure what it was, and I get more and more distressed.
Exactly.
And I'm more difficult then for Bernie to help.
That's right. And then other things become the issue. The aggression becomes the issue, the anger becomes the issue, whereas in fact the communication is the issue. And if we get that simple and straightforward, we can often keep the person within a reasonable emotional frame so that they stay in a reasonably good state. You know what it is to feel good about yourself, and that's the way all of us want to be. So poor communication, or at least communication that is not matched to the person's ability to be successful at it, might trigger the person into a negative emotional state, either anxious or afraid or angry or sad, that in fact takes them away from the purpose of your interaction with them and then makes it difficult. So it's doubly difficult.
I was asking around staff before you were coming in just about their experiences, and they gave me a great example of that. They were taken by a friend to see her, the friend's auntie, who was in a some sort of facility in another country, and they introduced her by saying, "Oh, here she is. You remember her, don't you, Auntie Gwen? You remember her? Come on, no, you remember her. You remember." And in the end, Auntie Gwen got so upset she was banging the table in upset and frustration. And the ABC employees just going, "Oh, this is terrible. This isn't how the visit was supposed to go." It's a great example of the wrong language, the wrong interaction.
Yeah, and I fell into it the other day myself. I was up at the Alzheimer's Association conference, or the Alzheimer's Australia conference in Brisbane. And as they do at the conference, they had quite a few people there who had dementia, and their husbands or wives or sons or daughters were with them. And I was speaking to one of the people with dementia, and their wife was standing there with them, and I said, "Did you have a good time last night at the dinner?" Now, what I did inadvertently was cause him to have to confront the fact that he couldn't remember last night's dinner. And as soon as I realised what I'd done, I changed it to describe what I experienced at the dinner, and I started to describe it rather than ask him to recall it. So we can all fall into this so easily because we presume memory.
Yeah, and it's a shifting sand because once we get our handle around what the person can remember, we think, "Oh, well, that's it." But then the boundaries get moved.
Yes.
And so we need to be very switched on as a carer. And, you know, there's so much to talk about here, Bernie, because we haven't even talked about trying to deal with sadness. Let's step back a bit, though. Bernie McCarthy is who you're chatting to. You can SMS 0437 774 774. Give us a call and he can chat to you, 1300 222 774. He'll also be online after 3 o'clock. If you'd like to be a part of that discussion, just jump on abc.net.au/Melbourne and register so that at 3 o'clock you can start banging out questions. This SMS: "Often my auntie can recall her memories from youth. Am I right to always bring this up with her to give her the satisfaction of being able to recall it quickly?"
I would say yes.
So anything that they can remember, anything the patient can remember is a positive, basically.
Anything the person can remember that provides them with pleasure. And think about what puts them in a positive mood, what helps them to feel good. And it will often be memories from the past that have a good association. Now, some people won't have memories from the past that provide good association. In fact, they will have traumatic memories, in which case you might work around those experiences and find other memories and topics that are pleasurable, provide positive mood, give them a sense of identity that's more successful and more happy for them.
Let's talk about VIPs. What are VIPs? You write about them quite a lot in the book. What are they?
Yeah, VIPS is a model, if you like, or a framework for understanding what person-centred care is. And it was created by a lady by the name of Dawn Brooker, who's a professor over at the University of Worcester in the UK. And Dawn Brooker identified four elements to person-centred approach. She suggested that we need to have a respect for the value of the person, the V, regardless of their disability. I is providing individualised care. P is providing that care from the perspective of the person, and S is ensuring that we respect the social capacities of the person, that even in the face of their dementia, they still retain the capacity for relationship.
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because carers who are close to the patient experience the sadness of loss as they watch the loved one disappearing from them. And it seems to me this is often starts to express itself in frustration and anger because of disappointment. Yeah. And fear, maybe, are the triggers of those experiences. But what comes out is frustration and anger in communication and tone, attitudes.
Yeah, and if we drill down a little further underneath that, often we can find pain, and it's the psychological pain of loss. Because what the person is experiencing is the daily awareness and confronting of the fact that I'm losing this person I love and cherish. And if there's a lifetime of 50 or 60 years of marriage behind it, there's enormous grief.
Yeah, absolutely. Bernie's book is very good at giving carers, I think it's very good, at giving carers a plan. The first part of the book explains in detail, but in very simple terms, how the brain functions, in what way we divide the brain up and all that kind of stuff. But then there's all sorts of things, not only ways of thinking about your communication, but there's quite a long, goes for a couple of pages for carers of all sorts, on life story profiling. What is a life story profile? What is it and why do you think it's so important?
Life story profile is a framework for asking questions of various topics that help you to build up a biography, if you like, or a life story for the person that you're caring for. Now, most of you who are husbands or wives or sons or daughters of people who have dementia, and if you're caring for them, you have that first-hand knowledge of them and their life story, and you probably know more than you're aware of knowing. So what I've done in the book is put together a structure to help you put together some questions that you might be able to put to the person with dementia without causing them any distress, that help you to put together a life story, a story or a narrative that enables you and others later on perhaps to continue to know the person well, because in a sense what we do is we hold their identity in the way that we offer them cues to memory as time goes on. Because remember, this is a gradually declining condition, so the person's ability to tell their own story becomes gradually more and more impaired. So
we have to have the triggers.
Yes.
We have to have those little starter fire lighters.
That's right.
To have with us so that we can trot out and go, I remember you used to go to France and that was horrible. Remember, we wouldn't say that. So
you just make a statement. You used to go to France, and that was really horrible.
Yeah, make it a statement, not a question. And let them. Do you remember?
That's right. And let them take it if they want to take it up, and if they do find it stimulating, they will take it up. So really, it's about throwing it out there, offering an opportunity. Mm. So that's what you're doing, is offering opportunity for stimulus.
To see if you can get a connection, one of the brain synapses to click in and go, oh, that information, I can process that.
That's right. And like the net that we spoke about a moment ago, that net will be triggered off, and there might be all sorts of associations that take the conversation in many different directions that you might never have anticipated.
And just as the example you give, you know, it's important to know the negative too. In the case study you give, the patient doesn't like porridge, and the reason it doesn't like porridge is because he had to stay at his grandma's and have porridge every day when his mum was sick as a little kid. So for him, the memory that comes up is a negative one. So we're saying, eat your porridge. It's really good for you. It's low GI and it's great in the morning and that'll fuel you. And he's like, yeah, I know. This illness.
That's right.
There's but it's about awareness of the individual.
Underground associations that we are not necessarily aware of.
You can SMS and ask Bernie questions, 0437 774 774. When I visited my mum in the Alzheimer's wing of the nursing home, I was careful to say my name is Kay. What should I call you? Unlike my sister who said, hi, mum, and started an argument. And it's interesting in that SMS, we hear a lot. First of all, the difficulties of coming to terms with your parent who's got Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And the second of all, the cracks that appear in the sibling relationship, because what's implicit in that SMS is she's not doing it the right way.
That's right.
And I keep telling her she's not doing it the right way, and she still keeps doing it. And so that rather than drawing together at a time of stress, they're getting fractured apart. And it seems to me that this is all a reflection of the different way in which people grieve. So what is their way through that kind of thing?
Well, I think having a relative with dementia places stress on the entire family. And I think if you can accept that that is the space that the family's going into, that at least enables you to accept that, okay, everybody is not going to be behaving all that well at times, because when we're under stress, rarely do we behave well. We end up doing all sorts of things that are really difficult for other people when we're stressed. But I think when it comes to families and their functioning, they need to access support and information. And one of the best places for that support and information is through Alzheimer's Australia. They have a national helpline, which is readily available, and a place where they can access support individually, or they can access the support in groups as a family. And it's quite often very helpful, particularly in the early days, to get as much information as you can. And that way, you can make sure that you're actually acting on appropriate information, because there's a lot of folklore about dementia.
Absolutely. Do you also have to let it go? That if your sister, for example, in this case, if your sister ignores or won't read the information, do you have to just accept that her contacts with mum might be arguments?
Oh, yes.
Like, yes. Or are you setting up another war? You're dealing with your mum with dementia and you've got a second front to the war. Mm. Fighting your sister to behave in the manner in which you think is correct.
Yes, you've got enough to deal with.
So you've got to let it go.
Let it go.
And go, well, the relationship with mum and my sister might be that she has arguments and distresses mum.
Yeah. And this is where, deal with what you can change. You can't change your sister or her approach. So deal with what you can change. And the history between your sister and your mother is theirs. It's not yours. You have your own relationship with your mother.
It's complex, isn't it? Talk about a net. You use that very good analogy of, you know, when you pull one string on the net, and the same could be said of family. Mm. The interrelationships within the family, and one gets pulled and all of them react in various ways to the pull.
Oh, yes. Families are wonderful most of the time.
Most of the time. My mum has a rare form of dementia called Lewy body.
Lewy bodies?
Lewy body. Do you know anything about it that you can tell us about?
Lewy body dementia is a type of dementia that has been more specifically identified in the last 15, 20 years, particularly by researchers in the UK. And there's a belief now that it has been underdiagnosed in the past and often misdiagnosed as Parkinson's disease or Parkinson's dementia, particularly because there's a very Parkinsonian type of effect that Lewy body dementia has, and that is it affects people's movements, much as Parkinson's disease does. So it's also characterized by very vivid visual hallucinations, so that's very upsetting for the person, particularly as they move through the disease. And it also affects their condition in the sense that it fluctuates enormously. So the person may be able to move and to hold utensils at one meal, but the next meal they may not be. And it can affect their gait, their movements, their ability to function, and with these quite marked changes. So very difficult for the person, very difficult for carers, and there's around about 5 to 10% of people who are diagnosed with dementia are believed to have Lewy body dementia these days.
Bernie McCarthy is who you're chatting to. Hearing the Person with Dementia, A Person-Centered Approach to Communication for Families and Caregivers is the name of his book. Dementia sufferers, says this SMS, are often very depressed. How do I deal with that?
Yes, depression is, the rates of depression in people with dementia are much higher, and the belief is that from the research is suggesting that the disturbance in levels of neurons and levels of neurotransmitters, or the chemicals that help the neurons to function appropriately, are lower or changed from what they should be. Mm. So it affects people in all sorts of ways. So they do get mental health conditions that you wouldn't normally associate with dementia, such as hallucinations or depression or anxiety reactions.
Do they benefit then from medication that that boosts those sort of things, you know, from serotonin boosters or...
The use of antidepressants, yeah. And bear in mind, this, I'm a psychologist, not a doctor, so I'm put that disclaimer out there. But from just knowing how they are used, yes, the use of antidepressants is quite common for people with dementia.
Apart from medicate to get the chemical balance back, what else can we do? I guess what I'm thinking is that this relates to that sense of, You write quite a bit about having little victories, re-establishing those connections, making people feel secure in their knowledge, whatever knowledge is left to them, is helping the mood state.
That's right. I think, as with any relationship that we have with somebody who doesn't have dementia, what we need to do is come to what you might call a homeostasis, or a place of peace between us, a place of calm. And I think the way we do that often with the person with dementia is to to trigger off memories and to trigger off positive associations. And you can do that very simply with a lot of your body language, through your smile, your look, your tone of voice, your posture, your pace of movement. And it might be that you need to provide them with access to something that's familiar, because familiar things generally are comfortable, and that provides us with access to positive mood. So if you provide them with a comfortable environment that's familiar, and routine generally provides us with familiarity.
How important is repetition in this whole process?
It's very important. It's the repetition provides us with the possibility of stimulating memory and sustaining memory. Because even though the disease is causing a decline in memory, what we can do is work against that by repeating various pieces of information, short statements that are targeted, that are appropriate to what you want the person to learn. And bear in mind, the person with dementia can still learn.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's important here. Because as the person is diagnosed with the disease, they may still have all of their abilities, but only gradually do they lose those over many, many years, 10 to 15 years.
So it's about keeping that information for learning within the space of the memory loss.
Exactly. Within their memory span.
Yes, memory span.
So. Yeah, so it's called spaced retrieval. And what we do then is we ask the person to retrieve that from their memory. So you might be saying, when you need to go to the toilet, you look for the red door. Okay, so what I'm getting them to associate is toilet, red door. So what I might do is paint the toilet door in the house red. Now, I'm not expecting every person in Melbourne to paint their toilet doors red, but what you're doing is you're providing a stimulus and a place of significant association, so that colour can be used as a trigger for associating, that's where I go when I look for the toilet.
And then is it a little bit like when we were training our little kids, that repeated reminders, repeated repetition?
Yeah, human beings need repetition. They need regular action, regular stimulus
patterns.
Of regular patterns, so that they have lunch at the same sort of time, they have the same process around certain things like dressing or showering that actually cause the brain to be supported. If you think about the way you learnt to drive, when you first sat down behind the wheel of the car, how unfamiliar was that?
Mm.
And what did that do to your mood?
Mm.
That threw you into anxiety, stress. But now what's driving like for you? Hopefully it's improved a lot. And you can now sit behind the wheel of a car calmly. You can be off planning your holiday or do whatever you're doing. And the weird thing is everybody else on the road is doing exactly the same thing.
Mm.
So we're all off thinking about something else while we're driving along. And that's one of the things that the human brain makes us capable of doing, is it makes things automatic for us, providing they've been what we call overlearned, learned so well so that we don't actually have to think consciously about them. Like tying your shoelaces, or you know, getting dressed in the right order so you don't put your undies over the top of your tracksuit.
My dad had Alzheimer's. Now my husband is displaying early signs. Do I make him confront it by seeking early intervention?
Well, I think you need to talk to him about it for a start. Engage in a conversation and open a dialogue about this. And it's one of those difficult conversations you have in a family, between family members. And at times, difficult conversations have to be had. But if the reception is not positive, I'd leave it alone and then come back to it. But don't forget it. It's something that will need to be readdressed at times. But you know your person better than I do, and you're going to adapt your approach to make that possible for them. So that gradually over time you might make that a less scary or less negative topic to be discussed. And you might leave some information around the house about it, so that gradually you demystify it or destigmatize it for them.
Yeah, it's such an important point, making it something that we can talk about as a third person. I'm not attacking you, Bernie.
Mm.
I'm talking about that third thing in the room, which is the disease.
Yes.
And then you can talk about that disease comfortably because it's not you.
That's right.
It's that thing. And then we can talk about it and go, oh, geez, Bernie, there you go again. That's the disease again.
Yeah.
And
otherwise,
I'm not attacking you.
Yes.
So your defences don't come up. Is that the theory you're going?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as soon as I get defensive, I'm not going to be listening.
Yep. Such an emotional topic, you know, in so many ways. And I'm thinking, I want to talk to you about the best way to care and the main things that carers need to keep in mind if they are not professional carers. A couple of SMSs that are coming in, 0437 774 774. Bernie, how important is music in all of this?
Oh, music can provide a great source of comfort for the person with dementia, as it can for all of us. Music continues to play a role for the person. As if it's been important for them before they had dementia, then it's probably going to continue to be important for them. Music affects mood. Music can associate itself with memories, so that the person may well be calmed by a piece of music. There was a belief a few years back that a lot of Mozart's music was, Baroque sort of music. Now, I don't know enough about Mozart to know whether that was the correct association, but that was particularly effective in calming people and providing a stimulus for
because
positive mood.
Is that the regularity of it. Okay.
But also good melodious music, there are going to be lots of associations to that. And if you're in an aged care home, when I was first working in this area about 10 or 15 years ago, I'd hear a lot of music that was associated with the Second World War period, because the belief was that that was the period of time that people would find pleasurable to remember. What you find now as you go into a lot of aged care homes is a bit of the 1950s, some 1960s. You'll get a lot of Elvis. You'll get a lot of variety in music. So it does depend on what people's tastes have been. But in terms of dementia care, you'll often find the use of music as something to calm people and to help them, particularly during, say, meal times or at other times where there might be a lot of agitation. Putting on some music can help to really soothe.
Let's say that, okay, you're going to start to care for me. I have some form of dementia. What do you need to learn as a carer? What do you need to be thinking about as a carer?
Well, the first thing I would do is try to find out as much as I could about you, about what was important to you, what's happened to you in your life, who's been important to you, who have your loves been, who have your losses been, what events have been important in shaping you and your personality. I'd also like to know how the dementia is affecting you, particularly, say, in your day-to-day life. I'd like to know what your particular neurological impairment was. For some people, it'll be more memory loss, and it'll be some things that they can't remember regularly, but it won't be total memory loss. So the dementia will show itself up differently in different people, so I need to find that out about you.
What about if we're brothers? What about if there's an existing relationship and you're a civilian? Mm-hmm. So now try and pretend that we're related and we have a long history, and let's also pretend that you have no knowledge of this area. What are the key things? Because we've already spoken of the sadness that triggers frustration and anger towards patients when you're busy dealing with someone who's not doing what you told them and keeps mucking it up, you know, these kind of things. So what do you think that carer needs to be aware of? What do you think that carer needs to know?
I think one of the principal things they need to be aware of is their own self-talk. What are you telling yourself about the situation currently? Are you saying to yourself,
Jesus, he's a burden?
That's right.
This is a nightmare. My life's on hold. Oh,
he's just being difficult.
He's just being difficult.
He's doing it deliberately.
Dad always did this kind of mucking us around.
That's right. So if I get those negative self-conversations going, then what I'm going to do is take myself into a sense of frustration very quickly. So stop that sort of talk and find yourself just asking yourself, what's actually happening out there? What am I seeing? What's he actually doing? Not what do I think he's doing? What am I interpreting him doing? But what's he actually doing?
Lots of SMSs are coming in. 0437 774 774. Richard, my dad passed away recently after suffering dementia. We found it important to keep basic routine in his life. Don't argue, don't laugh at them, and be very patient. And from Maureen, I'm a physio who works with people with dementia. I try and find out what sport or activities they enjoyed and work that into their lifestyle programs. So it sounds like Maureen's doing the sort of thing you were talking about, where you find out the thing that will have a connection.
Yes.
You know, you used to enjoy marshmallow in the Scouts. Did you toast that? Here's a marshmallow.
Yeah, they're very wise words from both of them, yes.
I'm bad at this. How do you handle outright denial?
In the person with dementia?
Yeah, I guess so. This is the SMS. So I'm imagining it's the person in...
is denying that they have the dementia.
Nothing wrong.
Yeah. Well, the possibility is that they have that sort of natural defensiveness about many things, possibly, and that this defensiveness about dementia is just another. So you do need to be respectful of their denial, and rather than keep confronting them with the unacceptable thing that dementia is to them, you then pick your opportunities. Again, you leave a bit of information around, you have the odd discussion, you encourage them to visit the GP, you find all sorts of ways of getting them to take some action without necessarily attacking, because as soon as you attack, you get defence.
And I'm hearing in that you take a step back from your sense of urgency.
Yes.
That it's not, if they're in total denial, then it's not going to happen as quickly as you think it might or should be happening.
And if it's dementia, allow that. If it's dementia, it's not going to go away.
Mm. Bernie, you're looking after me. I need to have a shower. Don't want to have a shower.
Okay.
There's now a conflict between what you feel is good for me and what I want to do.
Mm.
What's our way forward on this?
I need to weigh up whether or not, in fact, it's necessary or how necessary it is for you to have a shower. If you've been incontinent, then I might need to say, okay, for skin integrity and for social reasons, you might need to have a shower.
No, you just think it'd be nicer. I'd feel better if I had a shower. Mm-hmm. I'm not incontinent or anything. It's just, you think, oh, you needn't sit around all smelly. We could have a shower and that'd be nice for you.
Okay, so
I
might put the shower on and let it run and encourage you to, you know, what about you come into the bathroom? We can just see how your beard's looking at the moment.
Mm.
Okay, come into the mirror, have a look at that.
So I'm trying to set an example of this balance between my rights as an individual
mm-hmm.
and my needs as a patient.
Yeah.
And how the carer has to juggle that. And, you know, pick your battles. And I'm kind of getting into that conversation, I guess.
Yeah. Your major priority is to keep the person in a state of well-being. Now, what does that mean? In a reasonably positive mood, frame of mind, etc., feeling okay about themselves. Because if you impose the shower on them, all you're going to do is create distress between you both, and the person will be much less likely to be cooperative later in the day. What you do is you set up negativity and you set up distress. So if you can back off, if you can renegotiate it in your own mind and think, okay, can I come back later and do this? How flexible can I be about this? Is there any urgency? So I'll try to negotiate it within myself so that I can give the person with dementia the maximum possibility to find a way forward positively in the future, which might be in an hour's time.
Mm-hmm. And we get another sense of the big role of the carer, that you've got to have time for this, that you can't be in a rush. You can't, I'm popping in for 10 minutes and Bernie, are you going to have your shower?
That's right. That's not going to work.
But it's not going to work.
Not going to work every time.
And I'm sure people do it that way. I've just got to pop through and I'll make sure Bernie has his shower and I'll get that on.
Well, here we confront the very essence of what a person-centred approach is about, and it's providing care on the person's timetable, not yours. Mm. And that's what is extremely difficult at times. And often it's a negotiation between your timetable and mine. So we can, I mean, the person with dementia.
There's so much more in this, isn't there? There's also that thing of me letting go and knowing that just by managing you in the shower, I'm not making you better.
Yeah.
I know I want to do things to make you better. You know, I think, if I'll get you in the shower and then we'll tick off these things and then we're doing it.
And all I'm doing, in a sense, is managing the moment.
Yeah.
And enabling you to still feel positively about yourself, and let's get through this moment.